The Great John was with him, along with Galbert Glover, Maige Mormont, Edmure, and a man that Catelyn did not know, a fleshy, balding man, with a cringing look to him. No lordling, this one. She knew the moment she laid eyes on the stranger. Not even a warrior. Jason Mallister rose to offer Catelyn his seat. His hair had almost as much white in it as brown, but the Lord of Seagard was still a handsome man, tall and lean, with a chiselled, clean-shaven face, high cheekbones, and fierce grey-blue eyes.
"Lady Stark, it's ever a pleasure. I bring good tidings, I hope."
"We are in sore need of some, my lord." She sat, listening to the rain patter down noisily against the canvas overhead. Rob waited for Sir Reynold to close the tent flap. "The guards have heard our prayers, my lords. Lord Jason has brought us the captain of the Mirraham, a merchanter out of Oldtown. Captain, tell them what you told me."
"Aye, your grace." He licked his thick lips nervously. "My last port of call afore Seagard was Lord's Port on Pike. The Iron Man kept me there more'n half a year, they did. King Balin's command, only, well, the long and the short of it is, he's dead."
"Balin Greyjoy?" Catelyn's heart skipped a beat. "You are telling us that Balon Greyjoy is dead?" The shabby little captain nodded.
"You know our pikes built on a headland, and part on rocks and islands off the shore with bridges between? The way I heard it in Lordsport, there was a blow coming in from the west, rain and thunder, and old King Balin was crossing one of them bridges when the wind got hold of it and just tore the thing to pieces. He washed up 2 days later, all bloated and broken. Crabs ate his eyes, I hear."
The Great John laughed.
"King crabs, I hope, to sup upon such royal jelly, eh?"
The captain bobbed his head.
"Aye, but that's not all of it, no." He leaned forward. "The brother's back."
"Victorian?" asked Galbert Glover, surprised.
"Euron. Crow's Eye, they call him. As black a pirate as ever raised a sail. He's been gone for years, but Lord Balin was no sooner called than there he was, sailing into Lordsport in his silence. Black sails and a red hull, and crewed by mutes. He'd been to a shy and back, I heard. Wherever he was, though, he's home now, and he marched right into Pike and sat his arse in the sea-stone chair and drowned Lord Botley in a cask of sea-water when he objected. That was when I ran back to Mirraham and slipped anchor, hoping I could get away while things were confused, and so I did, and here I am."
"Captain," said Rob when the man was done, "you have my thanks, and you will not go unrewarded. Lord Jason will take you back to your ship when we are done. Pray, wait outside."
"That I will, your grace, that I will."
No sooner had he left the king's pavilion than the Great John began to laugh, but Rob silenced him with a look. "Euron Greyjoy is no man's notion of a king, if half of what Theon said of him was true. Theon is the rightful heir, unless he's dead. But Victorian commands the Iron Fleet. I can't believe he would remain at Moat Cailin while Euron Crow's Eye holds the sea-stone chair. He has to go back." "There's a daughter as well," Galbert Glover reminded him. "The one who holds Deepwood Mott and Robert's wife and child. If she stays at Deepwood Mott, that's all she can hope to hold," said Rob. "What's true for the brothers is even more true for her. She will need to sail home to oust Euron and press her own claim." Her son turned to Lord Jason Mallister. "You have a fleet at Seagard?"
A fleet, your grace.
half a dozen longships and 2 war galleys, enough to defend my own shores against raiders, but I could not hope to meet the Iron Fleet in battle. Nor would I ask it of you. The Ironborn will be setting sail toward Pike, I expect. Theon told me how his people think. Every captain, a king on his own deck. They will all want a voice in the succession. My lord, I need 2 of your longships to sail around the Cape of Eagles and up the neck to Greywater Watch. Lord Jason hesitated. A dozen streams drain the wet wood, all shallow, silty, and uncharted. I would not even call them rivers. The channels are ever drifting and changing. There are endless sandbars, deadfalls, and tangles of rotting trees. And Greywater Watch moves. How am I ships to find it? Go up river, flying my banner. The Crannock men will find you. I want 2 ships to double the chances of my message reaching Howland Reed. Lady May shall go on one, Galbert on the second. He turned to the 2 he'd named. You'll carry letters for those lords of mine who remain in the north, but all the commands within will be false, in case you have the misfortune to be taken. If that happens, you must tell them that you are sailing for the north, back to Bear Island, or for the Stony Shore. He tapped a finger on the map. Moat Cailin is the key. Lord Balin knew that, which is why he sent his brother Victarion there, with a hard heart of the Greyjoy strength.
Succession squabbles or no, the Ironborn are not such fools as to abandon Moat Cailin, said Lady Mage.
No, Rob admitted. Victarion will leave the best part of his garrison, I guess. Every man he takes will be 1 man less we need to fight, however. And he will take many of his captains, count on that. The leaders. He will need such men to speak for him if he hopes to sit the sea stone chair.
You cannot mean to attack up the causeway, your grace, said Galbert Glover. The approaches are too narrow. There is no way to deploy. No one has ever taken the moat.
From the south, said Rob. But if we can attack from the north and west simultaneously, and take the Iron Men in the rear, while they are beating off what they think is my main thrust up the causeway, then we have a chance. Once I link up with Lord Bolton and the Freys, I will have more than 12,000 men. I mean to divide them into 3 battles, and start up the causeway a half day apart. If the Greyjoys have eyes south of the neck, they will see my old strength rushing headlong at Moat Cailin. Roose Bolton will have the rear guard while I command the centre. Great John, you shall lead the van against Moat Cailin. Your attack must be so fierce that the Ironborn have no leisure to wonder if anyone is creeping down on them from the north. The Great John chuckled.
Your creepers best come fast, or my men will swarm those walls and win the moat before you show your face. I'll make a gift of it to you when you come dawdling up.
That's a gift I should like to have, said Rob. Edmure was frowning.
You talk of attacking the Iron Men in the rear, sire, but how do you mean to get north of them?
There are ways through the neck that are not on any maps, uncle. Ways known only to the Crannog men. Narrow trails between the bugs, and wet roads through the reeds that only boats can follow. He turned to his 2 messengers. Tell Howland Reed that he is to send guides to me 2 days after I have started up the causeway, to the centre battle, where my own standard flies. 3 hosts will leave the twins, but only 2 will reach Moat Cailin. My own battle will melt away into the neck, to re-emerge on the fever. If we move swiftly, once my uncle's wed, we can all be in position by year's end. We will fall upon the moat from 3 sides on the first day of the new century, as the Iron Men are waking, with hammers beating at their heads from the mead they quaffed the night before.
I like this plan, said the Great John. I like it well.
Gorbat Glover rubbed his mouth.
There are risks. If the Krannic men should fail you, we will be no worse than before.
But they will not fail. My father knew the worth of Howland Reed. Rob rolled up the map and only then looked at Catelyn. Mother? She tensed. Do you have some part in this for me?
Your part is to stay safe. Our journey through the Neck will be dangerous, and naught but battle awaits us in the north. But Lord Malister has kindly offered to keep you safe at Seaguard until the war is done. You will be comfortable there, I know.
Is this my punishment for opposing him about Jon Snow, or for being a woman, and worse, a mother? It took her a moment to realize they were all watching her. They had known, she realized. Catelyn should not have been surprised. She had won no friends by freeing the Kingslayer, and more than once she had heard the Great John say that women had no place on a battlefield. Her anger must have blazed across her face, because Gorbat Glover spoke up before she said a word.
My lady, his grace is wise. It's best you do not come with us. Seaguard will be brightened by your presence, Lady Catelyn, said Lord Jason Malister.
You would make me a prisoner, she said.
An honoured guest, Lord Jason insisted.
Catelyn turned to her son. I mean no offence to Lord Jason, she said stiffly, but if I cannot continue on with you, I would sooner return to Riverrun.
I left my wife at Riverrun. I want my mother elsewhere. If you keep all your treasures in one purse, you only make it easier for those who would rob you. After the wedding, you shall go to Seaguard. That is my royal command.
Rob stood, and as quick as that, her fate was settled. He picked up a sheet of parchment.
One more matter. Lord Balin has left chaos in his wake, we hope. I would not do the same. Yet I have no son as yet. My brothers Bran and Rickon are dead, and my sister is wed to a Lannister. I've thought long and hard about who might follow me. I command you now, as my true and loyal lords, to fix your seals to this document as witnesses to my decision.
A king indeed, Catelyn thought, defeated. She could only hope that the trap he'd planned for Moat Cailin worked as well as the one in which he'd just caught her.
Eddard.
Pain is a gift from the gods, Lord Eddard, Grand Maester Pycelle told him. It means the bone is knitting, the flesh healing itself. Be thankful.
I will be thankful when my leg stops throbbing.
Pycelle set a stoppered flask on the table by the bed. The milk of the poppy, for when the pain grows too onerous.
I sleep too much already.
Sleep is the great healer.
I had hoped that was you. Pycelle smiled wanly.
It is good to see you in such a fierce humour, my lord.
He leaned close and lowered his voice.
There was a raven this morning, a letter for the queen from her lord father. I thought you had best know.
Dark wings, dark words, Ned said grimly. What of it?
Lord Tywin is greatly wroth about the men you sent after Sir Gregor Clegane, the maester confided. I feared he would be. You will recall I said as much in council.
Let him be wroth, Ned said. Every time his leg throbbed, he remembered Jaime Lannister's smile and Jorry dead in his arms. Let him write all the letters to the queen he likes. Lord Beric rides beneath the king's own banner. If Lord Tywin attempts to interfere with the king's justice, he will have Robert to answer to. The only thing his grace enjoys more than hunting is making war on lords who defy him. Pycelle pulled back, his maester's chain jangling.
As you say, I shall visit again on the morrow.
The old man hurriedly gathered up his things and took his leave.
Ned had little doubt that he was bound straight for the royal apartments, to whisper at the Queen.
"I thought you had best know."
"Indeed." As if Circe had not instructed him to pass along her father's threats. He hoped his response rattled those perfect teeth of hers. Ned was not near as confident of Robert as he pretended, but there was no reason Circe need know that. When Pycelle was gone, Ned called for a cup of honeyed wine. That clouded the mind as well, yet not as badly. He needed to be able to think. A thousand times he asked himself what John Aaron might have done had he lived long enough to act on what he'd learned. Or perhaps he had acted, and died for it. It was clear how sometimes a child's innocent eyes can see things that grown men are blind to. Some day, when Sansa was grown, he would have to tell her how she had made it all come clear for him. "He's not the least bit like that old drunken king," she had declared, angry and unknowing, and the simple truth of it had twisted inside him cold as death. "This was the sword that killed John Aaron," Ned thought then, "and it will kill Robert as well. A slower death, but full as certain. Shattered legs may heal in time, but some betrayals fester and poison the soul." Littlefinger came calling an hour after the Grand Maester had left, clad in a plum-coloured doublet with a mockingbird embroidered on the breast in black thread and a striped cloak of black and white.
"I cannot visit long, my lord," he announced. "Lady Atanda expects me to lunch with her. No doubt she will roast me a fatted calf. If it's near as fatted as her daughter, I'm likely to rupture and die. And how's your leg?"
"Inflamed and painful, with an itch that is driving me mad." Littlefinger lifted an eyebrow.
"In future, try not to let any horses fall on it. I would urge you to heal quickly. The realm grows restive. Varys has heard ominous whispers from the west. Free riders and sellswords have been flocking to Casterly Rock, and not for the thin pleasure of Lord Tywin's conversation."
"Is there word of the king?" Ned demanded. "Just how long does Robert intend to hunt?"
"Given his preferences, I believe he'd stay in the forest until you and the queen both die of old age," Lord Petyr replied with a faint smile. "Lacking that, I imagine he'll return as soon as he's killed something. They've found the White Hart, it seems, or rather, what remained of it. Some wolves found it first, and left his grace scarcely more than a hoof and a horn. Robert was in a fury, until he heard talk of some monstrous boar deep in the forest. Then nothing would do but that he must have it. Prince Joffrey returned this morning with the Royces, Sir Balin Swan, and some 20 others of the party. The rest are still with the king."
"The Hound?" Ned asked, frowning. Of all the Lannister party, Sandor Clegane was the one who concerned him the most, now that Sir Jaime had fled the city to join his father.
"Oh, returned with Joffrey, and went straight to the queen," Littlefinger smiled. "I would have given 100 silver stags to have been a roach in the rushes when he learned that Lord Beric was off to behead his brother."
Even a blind man could see the Hound loathed his brother.
"Ah, but Gregor was his to loathe, not yours to kill. Once Dondarrion lops the summit off our mountain, the Clegane lands and income will pass to Sandor. But I wouldn't hold my water waiting for his thanks, not that one. And now you must forgive me. Lady Atanda awaits with her fatted calves."
On the way to the door, Lord Petyr spied Grand Maester Malian's massive tome on the table and paused to idly flip open the cover.
"The lineages and histories of the great houses of the Seven Kingdoms, with descriptions of many high lords and noble ladies and their children," he read. "Now, there is tedious reading, if ever I saw it. A sleeping potion, my lord?"
For a brief moment, Ned considered telling him all of it. But there was something in Littlefinger's japes that irked him. The man was too clever by half, a mocking smile never far from his lips. John Aaron was studying this volume when he was taken sick.
Ned said, in a careful tone, to see how he might respond. And he responded, as he always did, with a quip. "In that case," he said, "death must have come as a blessed relief." Lord Petyr Baelish bowed and took his leave. Eddard Stark allowed himself a curse. Aside from his own retainers, there was scarcely a man in the city he trusted. Littlefinger had concealed Catelyn and helped Ned in his inquiries, yet his haste to save his own skin, when Jaime and his swords had come out of the rain, still rankled. Varys was worse. For all his protestations of loyalty, the eunuch knew too much and did too little. Grandmaester Pycelle seemed more Cersei's creature with every passing day, and Sir Barristan was an old man and rigid. He would tell Ned to do his duty. Time was perilously short. The king would return from his hunt soon, and honour would require Ned to go to him with all he had learned. Vaon Poole had arranged for Sansa and Arya to sail on the Windwitch out of Braavos, 3 days hence. They would be back at Winterfell before the harvest. Ned could no longer use his concern for their safety to excuse his delay. Yet, last night, he had dreamed of Rhaegar's children. Lord Tywin had laid the bodies beneath the Iron Throne, wrapped in the crimson cloaks of his house guard. That was clever of him. The blood did not show so badly against the red cloth. The little princess had been barefoot, still dressed in her bedgown, and the boy. Ned could not let that happen again. The realm could not withstand a second mad king, another dance of blood and vengeance. He must find some way to save the children. Robert could be merciful. Sir Barristan was scarcely the only man he had pardoned. Grand Maester Pycelle, Varys the Spider, Lord Balon Greyjoy, each had been counted an enemy to Robert once, and each had been welcomed into friendship and allowed to retain honours and office for a pledge of fealty. So long as a man was brave and honest, Robert would treat him with all the honour and respect due to a valiant enemy. There was something else. Poison in the dark. A knife thrust to the soul. This he could never forgive. No more than he had forgiven Rhaegar. He will kill them all, Ned realized. And yet, he knew he could not keep silent. He had a duty to Robert, to the realm, to the shade of John Aaron, and to Bran, who surely must have stumbled on some part of the truth. Why else would they have tried to slay him? Late that afternoon, he summoned Tomar, the portly guardsman with the ginger-coloured whiskers his children called Fat Tom. Were Jory dead and Alan gone, Fat Tom had command of his household guard. The thought filled Ned with vague disquiet. Tomard was a solid man, affable, loyal, tireless, capable in a limited way, but he was near 50, and even in his youth he had never been energetic. Perhaps Ned should not have been so quick to send off half his guard, and all his best swords among them. "I shall require your help," Ned said when Tomard appeared, looking faintly apprehensive, as he always did when called before his lord. "Take me to the guardswood."
"Is that wise, Lord Eddard, with your leg and all?"
"Perhaps not, but necessary." Tomard summoned Varley. With one arm around each man's shoulder, Ned managed to descend the steep tower steps and hobble across the bailey. "I want the guard doubled," he told Fat Tom. "No one enters or leaves the Tower of the Hand without my leave." Tom blinked.
"My lord, with Alan and the others away, we're hard-pressed already."
"It will only be a short while. Lengthen the watches."
"As you say, my lord," Tom answered. "Might I ask why?"
"Best not," Ned answered crisply. The guardswood was empty, as it always was here in the citadel of the southern gods. Ned's leg was screaming as they lowered him to the grass beside the heart tree.
"Thank you."
He drew a paper from his sleeve, sealed with the sigil of his house. "Kindly deliver this at once."
Tomard looked at the name Ned had written on the paper and licked his lips anxiously.
"My lord, do as I bid you, Tom," Ned said.
How long he waited in the quiet of the guardswood, he could not say. It was peaceful here. The thick wall shut out the clamour of the castle, and he could hear birds singing, the murmur of crickets, leaves rustling in a gentle wind. The heart tree was an oak, brown and faceless. Yet Ned Stark still felt the presence of his guards. His leg did not seem to hurt so much. She came to him at sunset, as the clouds reddened above the walls and towers. She came alone, as he had bid her. For once she was dressed simply, in leather boots and hunting greens. When she drew back the hood of her brown cloak, he saw the bruise where the king had struck her. The angry plum colour had faded to yellow, and the swelling was down, but there was no mistaking it for anything but what it was. "Why here?" Cersei Lannister asked, as she stood over him. "So the guards can see." She sat beside him on the grass. Her every move was graceful. Her curling blonde hair moved in the wind, and her eyes were green as the leaves of summer. It had been a long time since Ned Stark had seen her beauty, but he saw it now. "I know the truth John Arryn died for," he told her.
"Do you?"
The queen watched his face, wary as a cat. "Is that why you call me here, Lord Stark? To pose me riddles? Or is it your intent to seize me as your wife seized my brother? If you truly believe that, you would never have come." Ned touched her cheek gently. "Has he done this before?" "Once or twice." She shied away from his hand. "Never on the face before. Jaime would have killed him, even if it meant his own life." Cersei looked at him defiantly. "My brother is worth 100 of your friend."
"Your brother?" Ned said. "Or your lover?"
"Both." She did not flinch from the truth. "Since we were children together."
"And why not?"
"The Targaryens wed brother to sister for 300 years, to keep the bloodlines pure. And Jaime and I are more than brother and sister. We are one person in two bodies. We shared a womb together. He came into this world holding my foot," our old maester said. "When he is in me, I feel whole." The ghost of a smile flitted over her lips. "My son Bran." To her credit, Cersei did not look away. "He saw us. You love your children, do you not?" Robert had asked him the very same question, the morning of the melee. He gave her the same answer. "With all my heart." "No less do I love mine." Ned thought, if it came to that, the life of some child I did not know against Rob and Sansa and Arya and Bran and Rickon, what would I do? Even more so, what would Catelyn do? If it were John's life against the children of her body? He did not know. He prayed he never would. "All three are Jaime's," he said. It was not a question. "Thank the gods." "The seed is strong," John Arryn had cried on his deathbed, and so it was. "All those bastards, all with hair as black as night." Grand Maester Malyon recorded the last mating between stag and lion some 90 years ago, when Tyre Lannister wed Gowan Baratheon, third son of the reigning lord. Their only issue, an unnamed boy, described in Malyon's tome as a large and lusty lad born with a full head of black hair, died in infancy. 30 years before that, a male Lannister had taken a Baratheon maid to wife. She had given him 3 daughters and a son, each black-haired. No matter how far back Ned searched in the brittle yellowed pages, always he found the gold yielding before the coal. "A 12 years," Ned said. "How is it that you have had no children by the king?" She lifted her head, defiant. "Your Robert got me with child once," she said, her voice thick with contempt.
My brother found a woman to cleanse me. He never knew. If truth be told, I can scarcely bear for him to touch me, and I have not let him inside me for years. I know other ways to pleasure him, when he leaves his whores long enough to stagger up to my bedchamber. Whatever we do, the king is usually so drunk that he's forgotten it all by the next morning. How could they have all been so blind? The truth was there in front of them all the time, written on the children's faces. Ned felt sick. I remember Robert as he was the day he took the throne. Every inch a king, he said quietly. 1,000 other women might have loved him with all their hearts. What did he do to make you hate him so? Her eyes burned, green fire in the dusk, like the Linus that was her sigil. The night of our wedding feast, the first time we shared a bed, he called me by your sister's name. He was on top of me, in me, stinking of wine, and he whispered, Lyanna. Ned Stark thought of pale blue roses, and for a moment he wanted to weep. I do not know which of you I pity most. The Queen seemed amused by that. Save your pity for yourself, Lord Stark. I want none of it. You know what I must do.
Must?
She put her hand on his good leg just above the knee. A true man does what he will, not what he must. Her fingers brushed lightly against his thigh, the gentlest of promises. The realm needs a strong hand. Joff will not come of age for years. No one wants war again, least of all me. Her hand touched his face, his hair. If friends can turn to enemies, enemies can become friends. Your wife is 1,000 leagues away, and my brother has fled. Be kind to me, Ned. I swear to you, you shall never regret it.
Did you make the same offer to John Aaron? She slapped him.
I shall wear that as a badge of honour, Ned said dryly.
Honour, she spat. How dare you play the noble lord with me? What do you take me for? You've a bastard of your own. I've seen him. Who was the mother, I wonder? Some Dornish peasant you raped while her holdfast burned? A whore? Or was it the grieving sister, the Lady Ashara? She threw herself into the sea, I'm told. Why was that? For the brother you slew? Or the child you stole? Tell me, my honourable Lord Eddard, how are you any different from Robert or me or Jamie?
For a start, said Ned, I do not kill children.
You'd do well to listen, my lady. I shall say this only once. When the king returns from his hunt, I intend to lay the truth before him. You must be gone by then, you and your children, all three, and not to Casterly Rock. If I were you, I should take ship for the free cities, or even farther, to the Summer Isles or the port of Ibben, as far as the winds blow.
Exile, she said, a bitter cup to drink from.
A sweeter cup than your father served Rhaegar's children, Ned said, and kinder than you deserve. Your father and your brothers would do well to go with you. Lord Tywin's gold will buy you comfort and hire swords to keep you safe. You shall need them. I promise you, no matter where you flee, Robert's wrath will follow you, to the back of beyond if need be. The Queen stood.
And what of my wrath, Lord Stark? She asked softly. Her eyes searched his face.
You should have taken the realm for yourself. It was there for the taking. Jamie told me how you found him, on the Iron Throne, the day King's Landing fell, and made him yield it up.
That was your moment. All you needed to do was climb those steps and sit.
Such a sad mistake. I have made more mistakes than you can possibly imagine, Ned said, but that was not one of them.
Oh, but it was, my lord, Cersei insisted. When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. There is no middle ground. She turned up her hood to hide her swollen face and left him there, in the dark, beneath the oak, amidst the quiet of the guardswood, under a blue-black sky.
The stars were coming out.
Samwell. The most perilous part of the voyage was the last. The Redwine Straits were swarming with longships, as they had been warned in Tyrosh. With the main strength of the Arbor's fleet on the far side of Westeros, the Iron Men had sacked Ryamsport and taken Vinetown and Starfish Harbor for their own, using them as bases to prey on shipping bound for Old Town. Thrice longships were sighted by the Crow's Nest. Two were well astern, however, and the Cinnamon Wind soon outdistanced them. The third appeared near sunset to cut them off from Whispering Sound. When they saw her oars rising and falling, lashing the copper waters white, Kojamo sent her archers to the castles with their great bows of golden heart that could send a shaft farther and truer than even Dornish yew. She waited till the longship came within 200 yards before she gave the command to loose. Sam loosed with them, and this time he thought his arrow reached the ship. One volley was all it took. The longship veered south in search of tamer prey. A deep blue dusk was falling as they entered Whispering Sound. Gilly stood beside the prow with the babe, gazing up at a castle on the cliffs. 3 towers, Sam told her, the seat of House Costain. Etched against the evening stars, with torchlight flickering from its windows, the castle made a splendid sight, but he was sad to see it. Their voyage was almost at its end. It's very tall, said Gilly. Wait until you see the high tower. Dalla's babe began to cry. Gilly pulled open her tunic and gave the boy her breast. She smiled as he nursed and stroked his soft brown hair. She has come to love this one as much as the one she left behind, Sam realized. He hoped that the gods would be kind to both of the children. The Iron Men had penetrated even to the sheltered waters of Whispering Sound. Come morning, as the Cinnamon Wind continued on toward Old Town, she began to bump up against corpses drifting down to the sea. Some of the bodies carried complements of crows, who rose into the air complaining noisily when the swan ship disturbed their grotesquely swollen rafts. Scorched fields and burned villages appeared on the banks, and the shallows and sandbars were strewn with shattered ships. Merchanters and fishing boats were the most common, but they saw abandoned longships too, and the wreckage of 2 big dromans. One had been burned down to the waterline, whilst the other had a gaping, splintered hole in her side where her hull had been rammed. "Battle here," said Zondo. "Not so long. Who would be so mad as to raid this close to Old Town?" Zondo pointed at a half-sunken longship in the shallows. The remnants of a banner drooped from her stern, smoke-stained and ragged. The charge was one Sam had never seen before, a red eye with a black pupil beneath a black iron crown supported by 2 crows. "Whose banner is that?" Sam asked. Zondo only shrugged. The next day was cold and misty. As the Cinnamon Wind was creeping past another plundered fishing village, a war galley came sliding from the fog, stroking slowly toward them. Huntress was the name she bore behind a figurehead of a slender maiden clad in leaves and brandishing a spear. A heartbeat later, 2 smaller galleys appeared on either side of her, like a pair of matched greyhounds stalking at their master's heels. To Sam's relief, they flew King Tommen's stag and lion banner above the stepped white tower of Old Town with its crown of flame. The captain of the Huntress was a tall man in a smoke-grey cloak with a border of red satin flames. He brought his galley in alongside the Cinnamon Wind, raised his oars, and shouted that he was coming aboard. As his crossbowmen and Kojamo's archers eyed each other across the narrow span of water, he crossed over with 6 knights, gave Kuhurumo a nod, and asked to see his holds. Father and daughter conferred briefly, and then agreed. "My apologies," the captain said when his inspection was complete. "It grieves me that honest men must suffer such discourtesy, but sooner that than Iron Men in Old Town. Only 1 fortnight ago, some of those bloody bastards captured a Tyroshi merchantman in the Straits. They killed her crew, donned their clothes, and used the dyes they found to colour their whiskers, 60 colours. Once inside the walls, they meant to set the port ablaze and open a gate from within, whilst we fought the fire. Might have worked, but they ran afoul of the Lady of the Tower, and her oarmaster has a Tyroshi wife. When he saw all the green and purple beards, he hailed them in the tongue of Tyrosh, and not one of them had the words to hail him back. Sam was aghast. They cannot mean to raid Old Town. The captain of the Huntress gave him a curious look. These are no mere reavers. The Iron Men have always raided where they could. They would strike sudden from the sea, carry off some gold and girls, and sail away. But there were seldom more than one or two longships, and never more than half a dozen. Hundreds of their ships afflict us now, sailing out of the Shield Islands and some of the rocks around the arbor. They have taken Stone Crab Key, the Isle of Pigs, and the Mermaid's Palace, and there are other nests on Horseshoe Rock and Bastard's Cradle. Without Lord Redwine's fleet, we lack the ships to come to grips with them. What is Lord Hightower doing? Sam blurted. My father always said he was as wealthy as the Lannisters and could command thrice as many swords as any of Highgarden's other bannermen. More if he sweeps the cobblestones, the captain said. But swords are no good against the Iron Men, unless the men who wield them know how to walk on water. The Hightower must be doing something. To be sure, Lord Leighton's locked atop his tower with the Mad Maid consulting books of spells. Might be he'll raise an army from the deeps, or not. Baylor's building galleys, Gunthor has charge of the harbour, Garth is training new recruits, and Humphrey's gone to Lice to hire cell sails. If he can winkle a proper fleet out of his whore of a sister, we can start paying back the Iron Men with some of their own coin. Till then, the best we can do is guard the sound and wait for the bitch queen in King's Landing to let Lord Paxter off his leash. The bitterness of the captain's final words shocked Sam as much as the things he said. If King's Landing loses Old Town and the Arbor, the whole realm will fall to pieces, he thought, as he watched the Huntress and her sisters moving off. It made him wonder if even Horn Hill were truly safe. The Tarly lands lay inland, amidst thickly wooded foothills, 100 leagues northeast of Old Town and a long way from any coast. They should be well beyond the reach of Iron Men and longships, even with his lord father off fighting in the Riverlands and the castle lightly held. The young wolf had no doubt thought the same was true of Winterfell until the night that Theon Turncloak scaled his walls. Sam could not bear the thought that he might have brought Gilly and her babe all this long way to keep them out of harm, only to abandon them in the midst of war. He wrestled with his doubts through the rest of the voyage, wondering what to do. He could keep Gilly with him in Old Town, he supposed. The city's walls were much more formidable than those of his father's castle, and had thousands of men to defend them, as opposed to the handful Lord Randall would have left at Horn Hill when he marched to Highgarden to answer his liege lord's summons. If he did, though, he would need to hide her somehow. The Citadel did not permit its novices to keep wives or paramours, at least not openly. Besides, if I stay with Gilly very much longer, how will I ever find the strength to leave her? He had to leave her, or desert. I said the words, Sam reminded himself. If I desert, it will mean my head, and how will that help Gilly? He considered begging Kojimo and her father to take the wildling girl with them to the Summer Isles. That path had its perils too, however. When the Cinnamon Wind left Old Town, she would need to cross the Redwine Straits again, and this time she might not be so fortunate. What if the wind died and the Summer Islanders found themselves becalmed? If the tales he'd heard were true, Gilly would be carried off for a thrall or salt wife, and the babe was like to be chucked into the sea as a nuisance. It has to be Horn Hill, Sam finally decided. Once we reach Old Town, I'll hire a wagon and some horses and take her there myself. That way he could make certain of the castle and its garrison, and if any part of what he saw or heard gave him pause, he could just turn around and bring Gilly back to Old Town. They reached Old Town on a cold, damp morning when the fog was so thick that the beacon of the High Tower was the only part of the city to be seen. A boom stretched across the harbour, linking 2 dozen rotted hulks. Just behind it stood a line of warships anchored by 3 big dromans, and Lord Hightower's towering, four-decked banner ship, the Honor of Old Town. Once again, the Cinnamon Wind had to submit to inspection. This time it was Lord Leighton's son Gunthor who came aboard, in a cloth of silver cloak and a suit of grey enamelled scales. Sir Gunthor had studied at the Citadel for several years and spoke the summer tongue, so he and Kuhuro Mo adjourned to the captain's cabin for a privy conference. Sam used the time to explain his plans to Gilly. First, the Citadel, to present John's letters and tell them of Maester Aemon's death. I expect the Archmaesters will send a cart for his body. Then I will arrange for horses and a wagon to take you to my mother at Horn Hill. I will be back as soon as I can. But it may not be until the morrow. The morrow, she repeated, and gave him a kiss for luck. At length Sir Gunthor re-emerged and gave the signal for the chain to be opened, so the Cinnamon Wind could slip through the boom to dock. Sam joined Kojamo and three of her archers near the gangplank as the swan ship was tying up, the Summer Islanders resplendent in the feathered cloaks they only wore ashore. He felt a shabby thing beside them in his baggy blacks, faded cloak and salt-stained boots. How long will you remain in port?
2 days, 10 days, who can say? However long it takes to empty our holds and fill them again. Koja grinned. My father must visit the Grey Maesters as well. He has books to sell.
Can Gilly stay aboard till I return?
Gilly can stay as long as she likes.
She poked Sam in the belly with a finger. She does not eat so much as some. I'm not so fat as I was before, Sam said defensively. The passage south had seen to that. All those watches and nothing to eat but fruit and fish. Summer Islanders loved fruit and fish. Sam followed the archers across the plank, but once ashore they parted company and went their separate ways. He hoped he still remembered the way to the Citadel. Old Town was a maze, and he had no time for getting lost. The day was damp, so the cobblestones were wet and slippery underfoot, the alleys shrouded in mist and mystery. Sam avoided them as best he could and stayed on the river road that wound along beside the Honeywine through the heart of the old city. It felt good to have solid ground beneath his feet again instead of a rolling deck, but the walk made him feel uncomfortable all the same. He could feel eyes on him, peering down from balconies and windows, watching him from the darkened doorways. On the Cinnamon Wind, he had known every face. Here, everywhere he turned, he saw another stranger. Even worse was the thought of being seen by someone who knew him. Lord Randall Tarley was known in Old Town, but little loved. Sam did not know which would be worse, to be recognized by one of his Lord Father's enemies or by one of his friends. He pulled his cloak up and quickened his pace. The gates of the Citadel were flanked by a pair of towering green sphinxes with the bodies of lions, the wings of eagles, and the tails of serpents. One had a man's face, one a woman's. Just beyond stood Scribe's Hearth, where old towners came in search of acolytes to write their wills and read their letters. Half a dozen bored scribes sat in open stalls, waiting for some custom. At other stalls, books were being bought and sold. Sam stopped at one that offered maps and looked over a hand-drawn map of the Citadel to ascertain the shortest way to the Seneschal's court. The path divided where the statue of King Daeron, the first, sat astride his tall stone horse, his sword lifted toward dawn. A seagull was perched on the young dragon's head, and two more on the blade. Sam took the left fork, which ran beside the river. At the Weeping Dock, he watched two acolytes help an old man into a boat for the short voyage to the Bloody Isle. A young mother climbed in after him, a babe not much older than Gilly's, squalling in her arms. Beneath the dock, some cook's boys waded in the shallows gathering frogs. A stream of pink-cheeked novices hurried by him toward the septory. I should have come here when I was their age, Sam thought. If I had run off and taken a false name, I could have disappeared amongst the other novices. Father could have pretended that Dickon was his only son. I doubt he would even have troubled to search for me unless I took a mule to ride. Then he would have hunted me down, but only for the mule. Outside the Seneschal's court, the rectors were locking an older novice into the stocks. "Stealing food from the kitchens," one explained to the acolytes who were waiting to pelt the captive with rotting vegetables. They all gave Sam curious looks as he strode past, his black cloak billowing behind him like a sail. Beyond the doors he found a hall with a stone floor and high-arched windows. At the far end, a man with a pinched face sat upon a raised dais, scratching in a ledger with a quill. Though the man was clad in a maester's robe, there was no chain about his neck. Sam cleared his throat. "Good morrow." The man glanced up and did not appear to approve of what he saw.
"You smell of novice."
"I hope to be one soon." Sam drew out the letters John Snow had given him. "I came from the wall with Maester Aemon, but he died during the voyage. If I could speak with the Seneschal."
"Your name?"
"Samwell. Samwell Tarly." The man wrote the name in his ledger and waved his quill at a bench along the wall.
"Sit. You'll be called when wanted."
Sam took a seat on the bench. Others came and went. Some delivered messages and took their leave. Some spoke to the man on the dais and were sent through the door behind him and up a turnpike stair. Some joined Sam on the benches, waiting for their names to be called. A few of those who were summoned had come in after him, he was almost certain. After the fourth or fifth time that happened, he rose and crossed the room again. "How much longer will it be?"
"The Seneschal is an important man."
"I came all the way from the wall."
"Then you will have no trouble going a bit farther." He waved his quill to that bench just there beneath the window.
Sam returned to the bench. Another hour passed. Others entered, spoke to the man on the dais, waited a few moments, and were ushered onward. The gatekeeper did not so much as glance at Sam in all that time. The fog outside grew thinner as the day wore on, and pale sunlight slanted down through the windows. He found himself watching dust motes dance in the light. A yawn escaped him, then another. He picked at a broken blister on his palm, then leaned his head back and closed his eyes. He must have drowsed. The next he knew, the man behind the dais was calling out a name. Sam came lurching to his feet, then sat back down again when he realized it was not his name.
"You need to slip Lorcus a penny, or you'll be waiting here 3 days," a voice beside him said.
"What brings the night's watch to the citadel?" The speaker was a slim, slight, comely youth, clad in doeskin breeches and a snug green brigandine with iron studs. He had skin the color of a light brown ale, and a cap of tight black curls that came to a widow's peak above his big black eyes. "The Lord Commander is restoring the abandoned castles," Sam explained. "We need more maesters for the ravens. Did you say a penny?"
"A penny will serve."
"For a silver stag, Lorcus will carry you up to the Seneschal on his back. He has been 50 years an acolyte. He hates novices, particularly novices of noble birth."
"How could you tell I was of noble birth?"
"The same way you can tell that I'm half Dornish." The statement was delivered with a smile in a soft Dornish drawl. Sam fumbled for a penny.
"Are you a novice?"
"An acolyte. Alaras, by some called Sphinx." The name gave Sam a jolt.
"The Sphinx is the riddle, not the riddler," he blurted.
"Do you know what that means?"
"No."
"Is it a riddle?"
"I wish I knew.
I'm Samwell Tarly. Sam."
"Well met. And what business does Samwell Tarly have with Archmaester Tybald?"
"Is he the Seneschal?" said Sam, confused.
"Maester Aemon said his name was Norren."
"Not for the past 2 turns. There is a new one every year. They fill the office by lot from amongst the archmaesters, most of whom regard it as a thankless task that takes them away from their true work. This year the black stone was drawn by Archmaester Walgrave. But Walgrave's wits are prone to wander, so Tybald stepped up and said he'd serve his term. He's a gruff man, but a good one."
"Did you say Maester Aemon?"
"Aye.
Aemon Targaryen?"
"Once. Most just called him Maester Aemon. He died during our voyage south."
"How is it that you know of him?"
"How not? He was more than just the oldest living maester. He was the oldest man in Westeros, and lived through more history than Archmaester Perristan has ever learned. He could have told us much and more about his father's reign and his uncle's. How old was he, do you know?"
102.
"What was he doing at sea, at his age?" Sam chewed on the question for a moment, wondering how much he ought to say.
The Sphinx is the riddle, not the Riddler. Could Maester Aemon have meant this Sphinx? It seemed unlikely. Lord Commander Snow sent him away to save his life, he began hesitantly. He spoke awkwardly of King Stannis and Melisandre of Ashai, intending to stop at that. But one thing led to another, and he found himself speaking of Mance Raider and his wildlings, King's Blood and dragons. And before he knew what was happening, all the rest came spilling out. The Wights at the Fist of First Men, the other on his dead horse, the murder of the old bear at Craster's Keep, Gilly and their flight, White Tree and Small Paul, Cold Hands and the Ravens, John's becoming Lord Commander, the Blackbird, Darion, Braavos, the dragon Zondo saw in Carth, the cinnamon wind and all that Maester Aemon whispered toward the end. He held back only the secrets that he was sworn to keep, about Bran Stark and his companions and the babes Jon Snow had swapped. Daenerys is the only hope, he concluded. Aemon said the Citadel must send her a maester at once to bring her home to Westeros before it is too late. Alaras listened intently. He blinked from time to time, but he never laughed and never interrupted. When Sam was done, he touched him lightly on the forearm with a slim browned hand and said, Save your penny, Sam. Tybald will not believe half of that, but there are those who might. Will you come with me? Where? To speak with an archmaester. You must tell them, Sam, Maester Aemon had said. You must tell the archmaesters. Very well. He could always return to the Seneschal on the morrow with a penny in his hand. How far do we have to go? Not far. The Isle of Ravens. They did not need a boat to reach the Isle of Ravens. A weathered wooden drawbridge linked it to the eastern bank. The Ravenry is the oldest building at the Citadel, Alaras told him, as they crossed over the slow-flowing waters of the Honeywine. In the Age of Heroes, it was supposedly the stronghold of a pirate lord who sat here robbing ships as they came down the river. Moss and creeping vines covered the walls, Sam saw, and ravens walked its battlements in place of archers. The drawbridge had not been raised in living memory. It was cool and dim inside the castle walls. An ancient weirwood filled the yard, as it had since these stones had first been raised. The carved face on its trunk was grown over by the same purple moss that hung heavy from the tree's pale limbs. Half of the branches seemed dead, but elsewhere a few red leaves still rustled, and it was there the ravens liked to perch. The tree was full of them, and there were more in the arched windows overhead, all around the yard. The ground was speckled by their droppings. As they crossed the yard, one flapped overhead, and he heard the others quawking to each other. Archmaester Walgrave has his chambers in the west tower below the White Rookery, Alaras told him. The White Ravens and the Black Ones quarrel like Dornishmen and marchers, so they keep them apart. Will Archmaester Walgrave understand what I am telling him? Wondered Sam. You said his wits were prone to wander. He has good days and bad ones, said Alaris, but it is not Walgrave you're going to see. He opened the door to the north tower and began to climb. Sam clambered up the steps behind him. There were flutterings and mutterings from above, and here and there an angry scream as the ravens complained of being woken. At the top of the steps, a pale blonde youth about Sam's age sat outside a door of oak and iron, staring intently into a candle flame with his right eye. His left was hidden beneath a fall of ash-blonde hair. "What are you looking for?" Alaris asked him. "Your destiny? Your death?" The blonde youth turned from the candle, blinking. "Naked women," he said. "Who's this now?" "Samwell, a new novice, come to see the mage." "The Citadel is not what it was," complained the blonde. "They will take anything these days. Dusky dogs and Dornishmen, pig boys, cripples, cretins, and now a black-clad whale. And here I thought leviathans were grey." A half-cape striped in green and gold draped one shoulder. He was very handsome, though his eyes were sly and his mouth cruel. Sam knew him. Leo Tyrell. Saying the name made him feel as if he were still a boy of seven about to wet his small clothes. "I am Sam, from Hornhill, Lord Randall Tarly's son." "Truly?" Leo gave him another look. "I suppose you are. Your father told us all that you were dead. Or was it only that he wished you were?" He grinned. "Are you still a craven?" No, lied Sam. John had made it a command. I went beyond the wall and fought in battles. They call me Sam the Slayer. He did not know why he said it. The words just tumbled out. Leo laughed, but before he could reply, the door behind him opened. Get in.